Our exhortation this morning is by Brother Robert Roberts. The exhortation is found in a book entitled Seasons of Comfort. The title of the exhortation is Daniel at Babylon. One of the advantages of our coming together in this way and reading the scriptures together is that it helps us to escape from the depressing effect of our own immediate circumstances. These circumstances are apt to impress us with the idea that we are established and that we shall never get away from them. They seem so real and lasting that though in theory we would admit they are only for a time, and that a short time, but are apt to be burdened with the feelings that they will never come to an end, and that things will always be as they are. And these things being evil things, such a feeling concerning them is liable to have the opposite of a helpful and cheering effect. A consideration of the things brought under our notice in the reading of the scriptures helps to dispel this dreary illusion and to exhilarate with the enlightened perception that the world is passing away and the fashion thereof, and that we and all our affairs borne on its bosom as on a stream are rapidly drifting to the goal of that futurity, the nature of which has been revealed to us in the writings of the apostles and prophets. This effect is produced as much by the history of what has been as by the promise and prophecy of what is to come. Let us take the example before us in the 9th chapter of Daniel, read this morning. The first thing that strikes us in the contemplation of the chapter is the fact that at the writing of it, Daniel was in the realm of the Chaldeans. That realm was at that time the seat of empire throughout the civilized world. Babylon was the greatest of cities, greater in relation to the world at large than London is at the present time, greater in her imperial consequence, greater in her architectural wonders, greater in the topographical extent, greater perhaps in her population, a city of mighty walls, of military greatness, of princely pomp and commercial importance and prosperity. Where is all this greatness? Where is all the glory and the bustle and the prosperity? Go to the banks of the Euphrates today and receive the answer in the wilderness of rubbish mounds that stretch away in miles of silent desolation where great Babylon used to be. What shall we say to this, but that the purpose of the Lord standeth sure, for it was not written centuries before even Daniel's day, Babylon, the glory of kingdoms, the beauty of the Chaldeans' excellency, shall be as when they overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It shall never be inhabited, neither shall it be dwelt in from generation to generation. But wild beasts of the desert shall lie there, and their houses shall be full of doleful creatures. The same word has decreed that God will make a full end of all the nations among them. He has scattered Israel, that the time will come when the haughtiness of man throughout the whole earth shall be humbled, and when the Lord alone shall be exalted, and when the whole earth shall be turned into the inheritance of the meek, the habitation of immortals, and the house of Yahweh's praise. This will as assuredly come to pass as the passing away of Babylon's glory, and we shall live to rejoice in the mighty change, if meanwhile we honor Yahweh in the reverence and obedience of his word. Then we look at Daniel himself. What do we find him doing? Studying the book of Jeremiah the prophet, from which he understood that 70 years would be the limit of Israel's desolation in Babylon. We may here note that we are in good company in the habit we have acquired of giving heed to and being interested in the writings of the prophets. If we cannot in this manner comfort ourselves with the countenance and approbation of the wise of this generation, we have the satisfaction of knowing that the prophet Daniel would be with us if he were in the land of the living, in the place we give to the prophets in our studies and affections. One such is worth more than an army of professors. For Daniel was not only inspired to know what human discernment can never attain, however insidiously applied, the knowledge of the future and of the purposes of God, but he was divinely honored in the very account of his interest in the sure word of prophecy. He was informed that from the first day that he set his heart to understand and to chasten himself before God, his words were heard, and that he was greatly beloved. We have next to consider the effects of this attention to what had been revealed to Jeremiah. The effect was a very profound interest and a very earnest solicitude concerning the affairs of Israel, a feeling so deep and strong as to lead him to make those affairs the subject of prayer and supplication with fasting and sackcloth and ashes. This was not by command or as the acting of a part assigned to him. It was the voluntary and natural expression of Daniel's individual feelings. A certain communication of prophecy resulted from what he did, and we are rather liable to assume that all that Daniel did was a matter of course and part of the divine arrangement. By this assumption, we derived ourselves of part of the benefit of Daniel's example, which, like every other part of Scripture, was written for our learning. Daniel's interest in the affairs of Israel was a spontaneous interest and part of his character. It is part of the character of a man who is really a child of the hope of Israel. It requires no stimulation. It is not an artificial requirement. It is the natural state of the man's affections who is begotten again to the lively hope that springs out of the purpose of God with the house of Israel. It is a something entirely foreign to the tastes and sentiments of all ranks and classes of Gentile society. The hope of Israel is an unfashionable affair altogether, and if we have to own and feel that in entertaining this hope, we are outside the circle of popular sympathies, we can at all events reflect with satisfaction that we have the society and good fellowship of the prophet Daniel, pronounced greatly beloved by an angel of God and commended to our attention by the Lord Jesus himself. Let us ponder one or two features of this prayer. Mark the opening words of his address to God. O Lord, the great and dreadful God. This indicates one of Daniel's thoughts concerning God, which may not be common, but which is undoubtedly natural to the subject. It may not occur to us, at first sight, to think of God as the dreadful God. We think of him as the good, the wise, the great. If we do not think of him as the dreadful, it is because our minds do not easily rise to the estimation of his greatness. In proportion as the mind opens to a just conception of the greatness, will it be impressed with the dreadfulness of the being who contains in himself the inconceivable immensity of the universe. It has been the characteristic of great minds in all ages to realize the dreadfulness of God in this aspect. It is a sign of greatness to be thus impressed, and to have a sense of man's smallness. It is a sign of smallness when man, either in self or neighbor, seems great, and when the universe is powerless to impress. Let us try for a moment to realize how much reason there is to think of God as the language of Daniel describes him, the great and dreadful God. It is a difficult effort, but one which is edifying and which perhaps become easier with the endeavor. We can only rise to it through what we see and know. That which we see is known and known is part of the greatness, so to speak, by the interpretation of which we are enabled, though in a very feeble measure, to apprehend that which cannot be seen or known. As Paul expresses it, the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things by which even his eternal power and Godhead, the things that are made, are before our eyes, at least in part of them, an infinitesimal part. In whichever way we look at them, if we look at them with the eye of intelligence, we see the tokens of matchless wisdom in combination with the stupendous power everywhere. beginning with the smallest objects, such as require microscopic aid to enable us to see them, we see the perfection of mechanical skill in the adaptation of means to ends. The structure of invisible plants, the organization of the minutest animalculi, shows the presence of contriving wisdom, even more palatable, perhaps, than the finished machinery of human life, or the beautiful proportions of the large animals, or even the balanced motions of the heavenly bodies. For in these cases, there is something on which the mind can plausibly rest the notion of self-evolution and regulation in the forces at play. But who can apply the principle of development or exercise and the survival of the fittest to the elaborate and delicate mechanism by which the functions of insect life, visible and invisible, in their endless diversification of form and exigency, are discharged? A few evenings with the microscope will enable anyone to find the force of this. From the teeming world of life in a glass of water, you turn to man, who seems by comparison a giant of colossal proportions. Here is every part of his organization. Herein every part of his organization is a machinery of exquisite contrivance, an arrangement for the generation and utilization of life in its highest animal form. From the crimson corpuscles of his blood, which can only be seen under the microscope, to the graceful contour of his Elohistic form and figure, his being in every atom and aspect of it brings with it the felt presence of eternal wisdom, which from without has fashioned into these exquisite forms the material supplying the basis of the organization. Then from one man you go to the thousands of a great town. From a town you extend your thoughts to a country, even so small as Britain, which with its thousands of square miles and its millions of populations baffles you in the attempt to mentally weigh it, as it were. When from Britain you vainly try to grasp the bull itself, you recoil dismayed. Your puny imagination collapses. Your mind will not stretch out to take it in. You are at the end of your journey long before you leave your native shore. Yet the earth is but an atom in the mass of the universe, a speck on the fields of space. Yet the sun itself, many thousands of times the dimensions of the earth, and around which the earth makes humble journey, is but a star among the countless myriads of orbs that deck the shining firmament. These are not fables, but demonstrable facts. The Milky Way is but an aggregation of the distant starry host, so dense as to seem a cloud of glory. Are we not baffled, staggered, bewildered, empowered by the greatness? It is a greatness that is a fact before our eyes. It is not the being who holds this in himself, a great and dreadful God. The dreadfulness is so great that we are liable to be drawn through to the other side of the subject, so to speak, and to feel as if the idea of one personal father were incompatible with such inconceivable immensity. This tendency we must resist. It is a mere feeling resulting from our smallness. It is not an induction of reasoning. If there is any reason in it at all, it is false reasoning. It starts with the assumption that mortal capacity is the measure by which the verities of heaven and earth are to be measured. It argues that because our created brains, mere agglomerations of atoms, cannot realize how one personally could fill and scope with infinite space, therefore they cannot be such a personality. Anyone can see the logical fallacy of this. There were eternal powers and wisdom before our brains appeared on the scene, and those were in unity, for creation is a unit as we see. Our brains are a mere contrivance of this power and wisdom in unity. Shall the limited, feeble, perishable contrivance set up its sensations in judgment upon the eternal contriver? This is what is done when men say the idea of God is too great for them to believe in. They are to be excused if they say God is too great for them to conceive of. For, as the scriptures testify, the reason declares, His greatness is unsearchable. But when they say, therefore I will not believe in the existence of His greatness, then they perform the most stupendous feat of folly, and earn the treatment to be accorded to men without understanding. Be it ours rather to recognize the self-evident fact that the Creator of the ends of the earth, who fainteth not, neither is weary, and whose understanding there is no searching, is a great and dreadful God, whom we shall adore and trust and worship and obey, and before whom we will order our ways with the modesty of becoming mere worms of the earth as we are, when compared with the sons of light as we hope to become in His great goodness and mercy. There is one other feeling which is natural and which we must equally keep at bay. We may avoid the mistake of making the surrounding greatness a reason for disbelieving in the personal form of that greatness in its root and power, and fall into another mistake equally harmful. When we have scanned immensity, we may think it as an incongruous idea that the mighty being in whom it all consists should deal with such small matters as occurrences among men on the earth, which are less to him than the motions of mites in a cheese are to us. From the Milky Way to Jerusalem may seem an impossible descent. Perhaps it does, but to whom does it so appear? To small man. Resist the feeling as the voice of unreason. Such a conjecture is only impossible to a mortal man. It is not for mortal man to judge the ways of God. It is great. It is part of the greatness of God to deal with the small as well as the great, to note the thoughts and intents of an individual's heart, as well as to regulate the stupendous movements of suns and systems. It is part of His greatness to sustain the numberless stars, and at the same time deal with His people Israel according to the law given by the hand of Moses. Dismiss the opposite feeling as an illusion of superficial thought. Say to deism, which makes God too great to attend to small things, "Get thee behind me, Satan." True reason is on the side of the Bible representation of matters. There must be detail to every form of things. There cannot be divine wisdom at work in the universe as a whole without that wisdom affecting its every part. You either must deny the wisdom in the general or admit it in the particular. Deny it in the organization of heaven and earth, or admit it in the resurrection of Jesus. Deny it in past eternity, or admit it now. Deny it in the fields of space, or admit in the history of Israel. Of what avail would be wisdom in the general, if not applicable in the particular? Of what true wisdom would be the splendor of the universe without a distribution of goodness to those inhabiting it? The framework exists for the filling in, the purpose of the performers, heaven and earth, for the fellowship of God and man. The Creator of all things, speaking to man upon earth, so far from being the narrow conception which the wisdom of the wise would stigmatize it, is the mark of true divinity. Let us bow before the glorious truth of the matter and rejoice. Let us take our place by the side of Daniel, the man greatly beloved, as he pours out his soul in confession of the sins of Israel when the time for promised favor had arrived. Daniel says, "We have sinned and have committed iniquity and have done wickedly and have rebelled, even by departing from thy precepts and from thy judgments. Neither have we hearkened unto thy servants the prophets, which spake in thy name to our kings, our princes, and our fathers, and to all the people of the land. Therefore hath the Lord watched upon the evil and brought it upon us. For the Lord our God is righteous in all his works, which he doeth. Now therefore, O our God, Hear the prayer of thy servant and his supplications, and cause thy face to shine upon thy sanctuary that is desolate for the Lord's sake. O my God, incline thine ear and hear. Open thine eyes and behold our desolations and the city which is called by thy name. For we do not present our supplications before thee for our righteousnesses, but for thy great mercies. Thus Daniel prayed in his old age on the expire of the appointed period of Babylonia's desolation. We live at the expiry of another period of desolation, much longer and more general, even the times of the Gentiles spoken of by Jesus, during which Jerusalem was to be trodden underfoot. Have we not understood by books the number of the years wherefore the word of the Lord came to Daniel the prophet and to his brother and fellow exile in after years in Patmos, that he would accomplish 1260 years in the desolation of Jerusalem from the time of the establishment of the desolating abomination of the seven hills? And shall we not at least, in the privacy of his own impassionate petition, set our faces unto the Lord God to seek by prayer and supplication with fasting and sackcloth and ashes? He that is able to receive it, let him receive it. And the joint prayers of many such Daniels, even their closed doors, may bring faith a response such as, in the dreariness of their acquaintance with evil, they scarcely allow themselves to anticipate. The response which Daniel received must have perplexed him sorely. While the words were yet in his mouth, the angel Gabriel came to him and touched him to bring him into sympathy, and said, O Daniel, I am now come forth to give thee skill and understanding. At the beginning of thy supplication, the commandment came forth, and I am come to show thee, for thou art greatly beloved. Therefore understand the matter and consider the vision. So far, this was very comforting. But Gabriel proceeded to inform Daniel, who was anticipating immediate forgiveness and restoration, now that the end of the 70 years had arrived, that 70 weeks were determined to set apart or arrange concerning his people in the holy city, to finish the transgression, to make an end of sins, and to make reconciliation for iniquity, etc. That this work would be accomplished in the cutting off of the Messiah the Prince, that to the time of his appearing for this work, there would elapse the entire period of the 70 weeks except one, from the date of the coming forth of the then impending imperial decree for the restoration and rebuilding of Jerusalem, that after his appearing, the people of the Prince that shall surely destroy the city and the sanctuary, and to the end of the war, desolations were determined, even until the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolator. Here was a something concerning which Daniel might well say, as he said in another matter, I heard, but I understood not. He was looking for restoration. His expectation was right. He was endorsed by the angel Gabriel in speaking of the forthcoming commandment to restore and to build Jerusalem. But after the restoration, here was the Messiah to be cut off, the city and sanctuary again to be destroyed, and the indefinite prevalence of desolation till a certain consummation, when the judgments appointed would be poured upon the desolator. It says desolate in the common version, but it ought to be desolator. It appears all very straightforward to us, because we have the fulfillment of the prophecy to guide us in the understanding of the matter. But we cannot easily realize the discouragement it would cause Daniel, whose interest and expectations were so strongly aroused on behalf of downtrodden Israel. Something of the intensity of his disappointment may be gathered from what he says in connection with the vision of the latter days, the time appointed, for which, he says, was long. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning 3 full weeks. However, that is all part now, past now. What we have to do is to look at the general bearings of the matter for our prophet. The 70 weeks have become plain from the course of events. They did not begin in Daniel's days, for though in the very year of his death the proclamation of Cyrus was issued, authorizing and inviting all Jews to go up to the land, The commandment to restore it, to build Jerusalem, did not come forth with the effect till the 20th of Artaxerxes, nearly 70 years after, see Nehemiah 2. In that year, the walls of Jerusalem were still broken down, and the gates thereof were consumed with fire. The date of the decree by the hand of Nehemiah was 456 B.C., the year of Christ's death, A.D. 34, total 490. Consequently, the weeks of the vision were weeks of years, 7 times 70 equaling 490. The cup of Israel's abomination was filled up by the crucifixion of Christ, and in retribution thereof, the Romans were divinely employed to destroy the city and the sanctuary, and to the end of the war, desolations prevailed as determined. These desolations have prevailed until now, but the time of the consummation has arrived, and they are beginning to abate. That which is determined is being poured out upon the desolator. The desolator in the current epoch is the Turk, and the sixth vial has been poured upon him with the effect of consuming and destroying his dominion and preparing the way for the kings of the east. This is the process now going on before our eyes, the desolator drying up, and the way opening for Israel's restoration. The process may appear slow, but it is unmistakable, and not really slow when estimated at the rate of historical process. The effect of the end of the vision is very different from the effect of the beginning of it. At the beginning of it, there was a long prospect of darkness and downtreading, which made Daniel dejected and cast down. At the end of it, the prospect of the sunrise is calculated to make us feel in the mood expressed in Solomon's song, "Lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of the singing of birds is come, and the voice of the turtle is heard in our land. The fig tree putteth forth her green figs, and the vines with the tender grape give a good smell. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. This will the Lord address his bride." Thus the Lord will the Lord address his bride on his arrival at the soon coming end of the present dismal night. We sing with truth, "Long hath the night of sorrow reign, the dark shall bring us light. God shall appear, and we shall rise with gladness in his sight." Yet a little longer, and he that shall come will come. He will not always tarry. Only for the appointed time will he leave the earth, unilluminated and uncomforted by his presence. He will say to us in due time, as he would say now, if it might be speak, "Be of good cheer. Though ye have lain among the pots, yet shall ye be as the wings of a dove, covered with silver, and her feathers with yellow gold." We have need of comfort, for the night is dark and cold and prolonged, and the voices of snarling wolves fill the air. There is abundance of comfort for us in the holy oracles, but with our weakness we often fail to get the full benefit. Let us never despair, but ever renew the conflict while the necessity lasts. The assembling of ourselves together helps us. In this attitude of obedience, God may have compassion upon us and help us still further in the wondrous ways to open to him with whom all things are possible.